for exam number 3, which will not be delayed from Friday. I will tell the story again. There was a student in your class that came to me this morning and very, very, just so respectfully, so quietly, and so, like, it made my heart go out for that long. She's like, could we please move the exam to Monday? You know, kind of like that. And the answer is no, because I know that you've got other exams and other classes going on, but does that mean my class stops? Because if every instructor stopped for every other instructor, then we'd all be just sitting around staring at each other. Are you going to give your exam yet? No. The fact is that there's sometimes that college just sucks, and that's usually at the end of the quarter, and that's the time that we're in right now. So, no, the exam will not be moved. There will not be paracyclic reactions on the exam. So it's only going to cover aromaticity and conjugation. I say only because we've got all kinds of topics. We've got activators and deactivators. We have orthopara versus metadirectors. We have is it aromatic, non-aromatic, or anti-aromatic, and we have all the molecular orbital theory that we had before. So there's a lot of things that could be on the exam.
So after the quiz, whatever you taught us after the quiz is not on the exam.
What was after the quiz? No.
Or nitration.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot about that. Nitration, acylation, alkylation. Oh, he's right. Dude. Yeah. So if I had 3 words of advice for the exam, it would be mechanism, mechanism, mechanism. Because you have those different reactions that you're going to have to write mechanisms for. Because if you notice, we still haven't done synthesis, so I'm not going to ask you to synthesize. So since you're not spending the time answering that kind of question, you're going to be answering instead mechanism questions, using mechanisms to explain why something is an orthopara versus a metadirector. Writing the mechanism for our nitration, for example. Explaining why something could be an orthopara director but a deactivator. Wow, that's 3 questions on the exam right there.
You should write that down.
I should, but I'm not going to, am I? Wow. Because you already know that's what's coming, right? Because half of you have past year's exams anyways that you're furiously studying. So,
what?
Well, the people curiously quiet right now know that they've had them. So.
What?
Oh, yeah. Because you all haven't figured out yet that when I leave these notes up at the end of the quarter, whoever signed up the next time around, as long as they download it before the quarter starts, the notes are still there, and I go over the exams with you all, which means that if they download the notes, they get those exams answers from past years. You hadn't figured that out yet?
No.
Yeah, notice that the former quarter's notes aren't actually up on the website right now, and I don't mention this when the quarter starts. And that if you all are really sharp, you might realize that the Chem 12C notes are still up and posted.
Oh.
Look at all those people. But anyways, so there is one more topic for the exam I want to present because it's very, very, very related to what we've already covered. And to preview this topic, think back to, again, orthopara versus metadirectors. Why does something end up being an orthopara versus a metadirector? It's all about that functional group, whatever is substituted on the benzene ring, being able to put electron density onto the benzene. Because we did the reaction coordinate diagram discussion on Monday, did we not, about what makes something a deactivator? So separate from resonance, there's whether the activation energy increases or decreases based on the functional group. And for most of the orthopara directors, because they have lone pairs that can delocalize, they lower the activation energy of the reaction. And then because they're doing that by having a lone pair, that's why they are also orthopara directors. Halogens are the exception, where because of resonance, yes, they prefer to substitute orthopara, but they withdraw more by electronegativity than they donate, and so that's why they're deactivators. And then we have the metadirectors that because it's an unfavorable charge combination and because it's pulling electron density off the ring, it's a metadirector and slows the reaction down. Okay, so take that thought now, put next to it this thought. Reactivity of carbonyls, which I know has nothing to do with a benzene ring, but you'll see where this is going. A carbonyl we can react in 2 different ways. again, we can push electron density onto a carbonyl. So now imagine that we're attacking it with a Grignard reagent, for example. That forces the carbonyl open, and that forces a negative charge onto oxygen. Of course, the other way a carbonyl could react is something like making an acetal, where first you start with an acid catalyst, which means you're trying to tease, to coax, to trick electron density coming off of the oxygen to then make the carbonyl more likely to be attacked. So in one case, you're pushing electron density on. The other case, you're pulling electron density off. And in that carbonyl example, when you're pushing it on, they're concerted reactions. When you're trying to tease it, it's a stepwise reaction. So in other words, whether doing cationic or anionic, you get reverse patterns of behavior. So take the idea of what we have with a benzene reaction and the idea that if you flip from talking about cations to anions, that behavior reverses, then let's see if we can explain the following behavior.
Yes, it does. I'm glad someone noticed.
Because it is 3:14 today, is it not? It's Pi Day.
Cool.
There we go. Cool. This is the day that if you run around the math departments, they usually have food or tricks or something going on, because that's what math people would get interested in, right? Pi? So.
I'm suggesting we go to the math.
I don't know what they're doing. I'm just saying that if it makes sense that anybody's got any goodies, it's going to be the math people. And I know that because I was a college student, and even more than college student, grad students operate by food. You say, oh, there's going to be a seminar today. Oh, that's interesting. Free donuts. What time?
I should write down 15 degrees.
So, chlorobenzene with sodium methoxide, no reaction. Why does SN2 not occur in this case?
Interesting is a good word. That's right.
Fill in the blank. Steric hindrance of what sort?
The benzene.
You'd have to actually pass through the benzene ring, because remember, in SN2 reactions, the nucleophile has to attack from exactly the opposite position of where the leaving group is. In this case, since the whole molecule is planar, that means that the leaving group would have to come through the benzene ring to attack chlorine, which of course it can't do, so that's why SN2 can't occur. That's one of the reasons. But there's also another reason, which is that vinyl halides don't tend to do SN2 reactions because the pi electron cloud repels the nucleophile. Why does SN1 not occur? Let me ask you this. If we took chlorine off and made a carbocation, would that carbocation be aromatic? Is the pi system actually affected by making a carbocation in this case? Because is the chlorine part of the pi system?
No.
Then why would chlorine reacting affect the pi system? So the pi system is this way, chlorine sticking out perpendicular. If you make a new carbocation that would have an orbital left over that would also therefore be perpendicular, that doesn't affect the pi system. So yes, it's aromatic, but it's incredibly unfavorable. Why? Carbocation? Sure, it's a good leaving group. Why is an alkyne more acidic than an alkene? hybridization, right? That SP, once it loses its hydrogen, that little lone pair goes into a lower energy orbital because it's SP instead of SP2 or SP3. Well, if a negative charge is favorable in an SP orbital, that means a positive charge is less favorable. So an SP3 carbocation is more favorable than an SP2 than SP because the positive charge is more exposed, less stabilized in an SP orbital. Besides that, what would the hybridization be at this position? SP, correct? Should be linear. Can you have a linear geometry in a six-membered ring? No. So due to geometry, the fact that it would want to be linear, and due to poor stabilization of the positive charge due to the hybridization of the orbital it ends up in, SN1 won't happen. I'm not going to ask any of this on the exam, but you should still know this. This is Chem 12A material. Great. So how does that explain the fact, then, that if we put a nitro group, either para or ortho, to the chlorine, that when you react it with sodium methoxide, you do get substitution? Now think about it. Can't be that we change sterics anyway, because we've now put a substituent even more in the way of the nucleophile. And it doesn't change the fact we have a pi cloud or a poor positive charge that would form, or the fact that it wouldn't be linear if you made a positive charge. So what's changed?
It's because in the nitrogen
before you
draw away from the ring.
Ah, so in nucleophilic aromatic, or sorry, in electrophilic aromatic substitution or additions, we need electron density on the benzene ring to attack an electrophile. Now the ring is being attacked by a nucleophile, and a ring is more attractive to a nucleophile if electron density is being pulled away from it. So the nitro group pulling electron density away makes it more attractive to a nucleophile. But beyond that, it also can delocalize a negative charge. So again, in the when you have a nitro group, it causes addition at a meta position if we're using an electrophile, because it avoids bad charge interaction. But look what happens in this case by it being in the para position. Oh, and in order to do that, I need to draw out the structure of nitro, which is just as well, because in one of the sections, and maybe I already came back and made this correction, because I abbreviated as NO2 one day, you did not see a very critical arrow that you have to use in these mechanisms, which I'll show it to you right now. So first, methoxide attacks. It does not kick the chlorine off at first. Reaction's not possible. The reaction occurs from the front side. That'll push a double bond open, which we could show pushing another double bond open onto the nitrogen. Nitrogen can only have four bonds. So the bond that I failed to show one day, the arrow, is this one I'm drawing right now, showing that the double bond there must open to, again, not exceed four bonds to nitrogen.
This is technically a reversible reaction. Although once this intermediate forms, we're going to see, even though it can reverse, there's something more preferable that will occur. It is a bimolecular reaction, yes, but it is not SN2. This is actually known as nucleophilic aromatic substitution. So once you form this complex, it'll decompose again. Oxygen, one or the other, can attack the nitrogen, pushing the double bond back around the ring. Once it gets to the position where the chlorine is, well, chlorine's a far better leaving group than methoxide. So the chlorine will be the one that comes off. That's not reversible. Chlorine's not a base. And so we end up with the substituted compound. So in the ortho and para positions, this set of resonance structures is possible. In the meta position, it's not. And let's see that just to yet again show the parallel but reversal of roles that's going on. So one more time, in electrophilic additions, when you already had only one substituent, see, notice one of the big differences in this reaction is I have two substituents that I'm playing with. In the addition reactions, you only have one substituent that's guiding where the next one will go. This is a case of one substituent changing the reactivity of the other one. In electrophilic reactions, nitro groups were electron withdrawers that was bad for the reaction, and it caused addition at the meta position. Here, having it in the para position is favorable now, again because we're having a nucleophile attack, and so it's better if we can pull electrons off the benzene ring. The meta position is where the nitro group causes electrophiles to go. The meta position is what fails to pull electron density off from the ring in this case. So everything is opposite. And why? Because it's a nucleophilic versus an electrophilic reaction. Which is why I made that point about carbonyls having reversed reactivity, whether you had a cationic or anionic reaction going on. I'm just going to abbreviate the NO2 because, as I'm about to show you, we'll never be able to localize onto the NO2. I left out methoxide. This is it as far as this reaction is concerned.
So the second reaction will not work? Actually.
Does not really work. If in real life, I would need to look this up. Maybe it occurs to a small degree because at least there is electron density being pulled off by induction. And so through induction, maybe that would increase the rate of reaction. It is by nowhere near as close to as favorable, though, as having the nitro group at the ortho or para positions. Questions? Shall we move on to our next topic, though, since we do still have half of class left? So we started working on paracyclic reactions on Monday, and let me just double check here how far we got. I don't think it was very far. Oh, we got nowhere with it. Okay. So, here's the situation that we had. One of the two situations. We have this compound, which, what is the name of that compound? Okay. What about stereochemistry? Can we use cis or trans in naming this molecule?
No.
No, because we have more than one double bond that must use a term, and when you have to use more than one, you can't use cis and trans. So E and Z, the top double bond. The middle double bond. Bottom one. Since the molecule is symmetric, and symmetric in both in terms of numbers and stereochemistry, it doesn't matter which end we start from. So this is 2E4Z6E octa 2,4,6-triene. This molecule, when heated, forms cyclohexadiene, and it forms a meso molecule where the two methyl groups end up being cis relative to each other, which is what causes the molecule to be meso. Why is it that under heat this becomes this particular compound? Why does it cyclize in this way? Well, I think we at least got through a discussion of ground and excited states. That when you don't have light, electrons tend to be in the lowest energy levels possible. When you do have light, an electron can absorb energy and move up to a higher energy level. Well, what energy levels would even be involved in this reaction?
So those of you who are writing, look up just for a moment. Notice that these three double bonds, it's not aromatic because it's not fully cyclic. But imagine that the two carbons on the right, the two carbons of the double bond, the ones here and here, imagine that the p orbitals there were to somehow turn towards each other. Because remember, a sigma bond is just when you have head-to-head overlap, not necessarily between any two specific types of orbitals. So if you had these p orbitals that for whatever reason started to turn towards each other, if those p orbitals now were to be head-to-head with each other, that would turn into a sigma bond. Of course, for those p orbitals to turn, they'd have to break with the bonds that they're already part of, which that in turn would mean they could interact with the p orbitals that were next to them. And that's exactly what happens. This is a paracyclic reaction, and I did write a reaction mechanism for that. Well, if it's the pi system involved with this reaction, then maybe it's the pi system's orbitals that we need to look at. So there are six carbons, so six p orbitals that would be involved, so there are six molecular orbitals. So let's draw those out. Just a reminder, because even I, for a minute, was thinking, crap, how am I going to finish this for the exam? Oh, that's right. This one's not on the exam.
There are six of them?
There are six of them, because there are six p orbitals in the pi system, which means there are six molecular orbitals in the pi system. And since this is linear, we're going to have 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then, not six nodes. Five nodes, 0 through 5. So, bottom case is easy. No nodes, we shade all the p orbitals the same way. One level up, one node. Two levels, two nodes. These three are bonding orbitals. Why? Because in a moment when we look at the number of favorable and unfavorable interactions between p orbitals, more favorable than unfavorable below here. So, I think the bottom one we don't need to show the indicators because it's all favorable overlaps. This middle one, here's favorable, 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 favorable. There's four of them and one unfavorable. When you transfer and your next instructors see you writing happy faces on these problems, they're going to wonder what kind of hell a place you went to when you went to De Anza. Above this, we have enough nodes that the number of nodes automatically, therefore, outnumbers the number of favorable interactions that we have. So here's three nodes. Four nodes. And five is the maximum. Every other one, opposite. Now, of course, we could just look this up in the book, but I'm one of those believers that if you write it down your own self, that's one way of learning it, because at least you did it once. And so notice this pattern, that when we have an even number of p orbitals, the number of maximum nodes is odd. And that means you'll always end up in this situation where half of the orbitals generated are bonding and then half of them are antibonding. If you have an odd number of p orbitals, then you end up in a situation where you have an even number of nodes, which means you can end up with an even number of favorable and unfavorable interactions, which means you generate a non-bonding orbital. So for even numbers of p orbitals, always half are bonding, half are antibonding for the molecular orbitals that are made. And for odd number systems, then one orbital would be non-bonding, half the rest bonding, and then, of course, the rest of those antibonding. Now, since I said it for the other section, I'll say it here too. For cyclic systems, there's a pattern as well. If you have 4n orbitals, so something like cyclobutadiene, then you're going to have two orbitals non-bonding, half the rest bonding, and then the remaining antibonding. If you have 4n plus 1 like cyclopentadiene, then you're going to have one more bonding than antibonding orbital. If you have 4n plus 2, then you'll have half bonding and antibonding like benzene, and if you have 4n plus 3 like the cycloheptatriene case, then you're going to have one more antibonding orbital than bonding. Not that I want you to memorize that, but because some people wanted to know, well, there it is. Now, what do we do with this mess? Well, there's electrons in here. Yes. Say that one more time.
Sometimes you just cross out.
So when I cross out an orbital, it's because the node passes exactly through the position of that atom. Mm-hmm. In this case, it doesn't happen.
And also, if you don't have cyclic molecule, is it possible to write that pi molecular orbital diagram?
If you don't have a cyclic, yes. This is the linear system. So, yes, the molecule is partially cyclic, and so it's curved physically, but the p orbitals themselves are still in a line. So that's why we're using these linear diagrams to describe it.
But what if you have, like, some sp3 carbons intruded in the pi system? Can you...
So what you're asking is something like this. They would be equivalent in terms of molecular orbitals to that. Ignore the sp3 positions. Ignore them, yeah. But it's not aromatic, so it would be a linear system. But you would just use the equivalent linear system then. Okay, now back to here. Six orbitals that need electrons. How many electrons are we going to put in? Six, because we have three double bonds. So, this is what is known as the highest occupied, I think we did these terms already, molecular orbital, but in the ground state, where everything is in its lowest possible energy levels. And that means this other orbital up here is going to be the lowest occupied molecular orbital. Thank you. Unoccupied, just making sure you're awake. So, what's the whole point of this Homolumo theory? Well, it's these highest energy electrons that are the highest energy electrons. They're the ones likely to react. The LUMO, that's the place where that's the lowest energy place the electrons have to go. Now, why are we worrying about this at all in connection with this problem? Well, if we think this is a paracyclic reaction, where one double bond pushes the next one, well, let's say it's this highest energy pair of electrons that begins that process. So that means that it is that particular molecular orbital that matters in this reaction. So let's take the physical structure of the molecule. And put on top of it a diagram of that molecular orbital. Well, notice that at the gate here, if you want to think of it that way, the 2p orbitals are shaded on top the same way. Okay, now realize this is just one molecular orbital that's got a complicated structure, but the ends of it have the same phase. So if those two ends were going to rotate to form a sigma bond, in order to do it favorably in terms of wave function, they would have to turn opposite ways of each other. So look over at me just a second. See my hands? It looks like you might be confused and say, oh, you're turning the same way, because from our human perspective, this hand's going to my interior, this is going to my interior. But if you look in terms of clockwise versus counterclockwise, from your perspective, one arm is going clockwise and one arm is going counterclockwise. Notice I've done enough years of teaching that even though this is really from my perspective counterclockwise, I knew that from your perspective, this is clockwise, isn't it?
Is it?
It is, yes. So they're moving in opposite directions. So this is called disrotatory motion. The p orbitals twist in opposite directions. That is why you end up with the two methyl groups pointed the same way. And because there's an internal plane of symmetry, this compound is meso, so it's not optically active. Now, why do things change when light is involved? Well, what would the electronic structure of the first excited state look like? Well, you still have to put six electrons in there. One, two, three, four, five, six. Because excited state means you've bumped an electron up to a higher level than the filling rules would tell you that you should do. All right? Well, that means that this is the LUMO for the excited state. And this same one that used to be the LUMO is now the HOMO for the excited state. So what does that mean? Well, let's go back down. Write that part of it down. Observe which orbital it is now that would have the highest energy electron. It has a different orbital symmetry. Notice the one we did previously, the two ends, had shading that was the same. Now, because we're one more node up, we've flipped the shading of the two ends. That means that the reaction is going to occur with the methyl groups now turning the same way as each other. So the ends of the p orbitals look like they're coming together, and they look like they're turned opposite ways from each other. But again, look up at me for a moment. So if, from your perspective, my left elbow is one of those p lobes that's going to react, and then my right hand, when they both turn the same direction, notice how one overlaps with the other. So they are turning the same direction. That is conrotatory.
And that does end up making the methyl groups relatively trans to each other. Which is why we get an optically active material. Yes? So it does matter whether or not there's presence of light. If there's only heat, the top one happens. When there is light, only the bottom one happens. And there's actually a summary of these rules that your textbook may give you called the Woodward-Hoffman rules. I do not want you to memorize those, because they go to something along the lines of this. If you have a certain number of p orbitals and there's light, then it goes this way. If there's not light, it goes that way. Unless you increase the number of p orbitals, then it's reversed. Well, if you forget even one part of it, like which way does it go under one of the conditions, you have to at least remember one of them to know how any of the others are going to work. This is the way I would want you to answer that question, to use molecular orbitals to rationalize which way would rotation occur. Now, we will do another example of this next week after the exam. Yes. Yes, after the exam. After the exam, not on Friday. Question, yes. So, if the two np orbitals, no, but you're talking about these two, right? Okay, so if you take the two p orbitals that end up being the sigma bond, well, you have two more p orbitals left over. Since it's not a cyclic system, it's not going to be aromatic. And technically, these four overlap, but that's exactly what you do have in butadiene. So by these two orbitals no longer interacting with the pi system shrinks, and you end up with a 4p orbital system, which means you have two double bonds. Another way to think of it is this used to be a double bond, so take this away, and this bumps over and makes a double bond with this. This used to be a double bond, which means it gets bumped over to be with this, and this goes away anyways because it's becoming part of the sigma. Same thing happens there. Both reactions. So the methyl groups are turning opposite ways, but the end result is the same in terms of the pi system.
But on the top molecule, you didn't show that there's a side.
That's not a reaction, if that's what you mean. In this one, this is the same result, that you make the two double bonds afterwards. It might help if I did this. To draw the mechanism in. Now we have just a couple of minutes, so let me preview a related reaction, the Diels-Alder reaction. The only difference, really, in some senses, is that this is a reaction involving just one molecule, whereas the Diels-Alder reaction is a reaction involving two molecules. But we're still going to use this frontier orbital theory to explain why Diels-Alder reactions occur the way that they do. So just let me give you a quick introduction to that. Or, you know, since there's only 2 minutes left, wait, is it really such a tragedy that we end class early just once? Questions? That's what's going to be on the question. Now, what's going to be on the exam? Orthopara versus metadirectors, activators versus deactivators. I'm not writing this down. Whether something is aromatic, non-aromatic, or anti-aromatic, and then mechanisms for the nitration, sulfonation, halogenation, acylation, and alkylation. Plus, the reaction coordinate diagram to explain why something is a deactivator versus an activator, and the nucleophilic aromatic substitution that we just did today. There's six things right there. That's six questions for an exam, isn't it? I'll do it one more time, but in another language. How's that?